Welcome,
go.
Will Ains. So we've turned this into a literary salon. I believe you're the 122nd-ish author I've interviewed since we've been here.
Nice. Thank you.
We are for, oh, it's my pleasure. I'm excited about this. This will be a good one. This is really my wife's place. It's Alexandrian cuisine, so it's Middle Eastern with French and Greek influences, and it's based on her family recipes from the original Alexandria in Egypt. We have authors in here all the time. So if you're an author or you know an author, please let them know. Free space, and we just like to be able to give people a place to celebrate their work. Pretty excited about this one today. Let me read the bio here.
There you go. Thank you.
So the Reverend Robert D. Flanagan has served as an Episcopal priest since 2003. He holds a Doctor of Ministry in Christian Spirituality from Virginia Theological Seminary and is a chaplain at General Theological Seminary in New York City. He has served on the Boston and Connecticut boards of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, the AFSP, and consulted with the AFSP National Organization to identify programs supporting clergy in preventing suicide. The author of Courage to Thrive, The Letters of an Unexpected Mystic, and Growing a Substantial, Sustainable Soul, Bob is a former collegiate rower and high school rowing coach. He and his wife, Lonnie, live in Old Town Alexandria in Litchfield County, Connecticut. So please welcome Reverend Robert Flanagan. So this book is really cool. I love it when we have people written like spiritual books and books that are make people be introspective. So it's really fun. Why don't you just give us a little bit what is the book about?
This is the second book in the series.
Hold that a little closer and canta. There we go.
Second book in the series of Courage to Thrive. And the first book was a spiritual journal that looked at people with mental health struggles and kind of how to address them through a spiritual lens. And the second book is, again, Courage to Thrive, but this one looks at the process or how we can learn about ourselves. And I really argue that we can do that in at any age. I mean, it's kind of typical of the teenage angst to kind of know thyself, and kind of their language when I was a school minister was always to, they would give their chapel talks as seniors, and they'd say, you know, be true to yourself. That was the advice they always gave. And they kept constantly giving it. So clearly they had struggled with being true to themselves, because every year everybody was saying, be true to yourself. So I don't think that was something they were good at. However, it's something that is something we deal with at any age. Take somebody who has a drastic change in, because of an accident. I know somebody was seriously injured in a car accident at one point in time, and it really changed himself and for who he was and what he could do in his day and how he could live. And so this book kind of looks at how do we know ourselves by reflecting about the relationships that we have with other people, with our bodies, with our environment, and then on the spiritual basis of knowing ourselves in terms of the Judeo-Christian understanding of God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit. So those are that's essentially the two books in themselves. And the newest one, the newest Courage to Thrive book, is really set up as a Bible study and does so in a way that I think whether one's really into Bible studies or not, they're going to find something there, because it really addresses both it addresses a wide range of biblical scripture, but it also addresses it in ways that bring in resources such as poetry or art or music, and through links online links and ways to kind of reflect differently on each of the relationships.
I find this so interesting. And so first off, congratulations on the
Thank
book.
You.
I mean, writing is one of those things where something like 80% of people say they have a book or plan to write a book and have it in them. And, I hope they do, and I hope they write it.
Right.
But once they start, it's like 3% actually ever finish. Or 3% actually dive in. I think 1% of the 3% finish. Like it's a crazy, and then I won't scare you with how few actually publish.
Well then, yeah. And then so the 1% that gets published, and then how many are the tortured souls that just keep writing?
Yeah, Yeah, no, no, there's so many. It's so difficult, and people don't realize it because we all read, right? So you read and you say, oh, I have a story, or that sounds good, this is so easy. But then once you get into it and you realize how much there is, it's difficult. So congratulations. I'm glad you can celebrate here and you have some friends and family.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's definitely my pleasure. I have so many questions because I'm so interested in this. So you just mentioned, you know, somebody has an accident and it changes who they are, what they can do physically. How much of that is just like reimagining their role in the world because of, like, say, a debilitating accident versus it makes them look at life and their role as like a human being differently?
I asked, it's interesting you raise that because I used to ask my high school students, what makes us us? You know, kind of what defines you? You know, what could you take away and still be you? And I said, well, and I was teaching during the height of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. So we were reading something around somebody who was dealing with brain trauma and had, you know, he had his Humvee was blown up, and it was a story about how he was putting himself back together. And so we would talk about kind of, well, if you lose an arm, you lose a leg, are you still who you are? You know, does that make yourself? You know, what defines us as a person, and what is personhood around that? And so even, you know, we'd have some of these kids who would come in to class and they'd be under concussion protocols, and they would, so their brain had been rattled in hockey or something. And still then, you know, what made them who they were, even though so often I would tell them, by the way, you know, you're 14 now or 15, and your cells have almost completely turned over twice since you've been on this earth. You know, about every 7 years they say that the cells turn over. So what is that core thing that makes us who we are? And it's hard to kind of say. And so what I would say with Courage to Thrive is the best way for us to understand who we are is in relationship with other people. And understanding myself is by how I understood by others and not in isolation. So I took a class in college about, you know, studying Descartes, you know, I think, therefore I am. And I would sit there and think, well, I don't know, that just thinking about myself doesn't really cut it. There was more to it than that. And I had it relied on a broader sense of who I was and who I could be to find who I am. And I know Carl Jung would say, he would add, well, experience is going to give that. And I'd say, I agree with him. I think that Descartes and Jung are right in that, but I also would add that the experiences are not done in isolation, but they're done in relationship.
So these are questions people have been struggling with since the beginning of time, right? Like, so these are not easy answers. So, but when you define something by relation to something else, isn't that almost a logical fallacy in that you there certainly is a relationship between the two, but it's avoiding the definition of the thing, right?
And I hear you. I see your point. But I also would say is that we are brought into this world to relate, you know, and I would almost say is, you know, I relate, therefore I am. That we're not ever kind of drawn into an isolation, that we can truly define ourselves by how we choose to relate to the world. If we don't, by fully withdrawing, can we actually fully withdraw? You know, can we actually withdraw from all the relationships and ways that we interact? We would say that even our home, that how we relate to our home and what does that say about ourselves, it pushes against that and saying, actually, that if we stop and kind of strip everything down to its basic essentials, then there's kind of very little. You know, if we can't relate with ourselves, our bodies, or if we can't relate with our home or other people, then what is life?
So are you looking at it more like a, that almost sounds like almost a utilitarian argument in some ways, right? Or is it sort of like this, I guess, is it Socrates, you know, looking at people for their value comes in the good of what they can accomplish? is, you know what I mean? Like
right.
The purpose, if you're
right.
looking at it from a religious
right.
thing, your purpose here is to relate to others and to do good for others or whatever. So to the extent that you accomplish that, is that how you're defining
so it's self? Yeah, no. So that's an interesting way to look at it as well, because I would say that, you know, we have goals and dreams for ourselves, for our families, and for what we want to accomplish. And then, as I like to say, then life gets in the way, you know, that we think, okay, we're going to live our life. You know, we're going to write down our series of goals. I'm going to finish writing a book or that kind of stuff. But, spouse, a partner gets sick, or we wind up, you know, diminished somehow physically or through illness. And so we can't only be defined by our objective and kind of adding to the common good, because sometimes we're prevented from that. And so kind of my look at is as a pastor, and my work as a priest is saying, yeah, we have goals for life, but then, and things that we want to accomplish, but sometimes, you know, other people, other things, other events prevent us from doing that. And so we have to reassess who we are in light of whatever that new thing is. So whether it's a cancer diagnosis or an accident that happens, or just another type of disease, and all of a sudden, all those goals that we had laid out are out the window, and we have to then relate to the world with this new, in this new way. So, yeah.
So, I mean, I think everyone can relate to that, where they've had maybe a near-death experience, or they've lost somebody they love, right? And it's made them reevaluate. So when you talk about like somebody with like a cancer or sort of a serious physical ailment, in a way it sort of separated them from the human substrate, from who they are beyond that, right? So in some ways it's almost a tool for self-discovery. Would you say that?
The illness,
and having an illness or having a serious injury to make you look beyond what you considered yourself.
Yeah. So in working with, as a pastor in a church, what you find out is often you're working these days with the people in the last quarter of their life. You know, so it's that last however many years that they have. It really represents kind of that last quarter. That's a lot of folks that are in church, and the what you find at that point is that they're confronting major issues, you know, cognitive decline, or again, you know, kind of an illness, or somebody falls and breaks a leg. And the challenge is can they, in that time, that moment of crisis, say, okay, how am I now? What is my body saying to me about who I am, and how can I relate to that newness? If somebody breaks their leg, breaks a femur, you know, what often you see is that they're stuck in bed. They've actually had a successful surgery, and they should be able to, with rehab, wind up, you know, living a satisfactory life. But they often think about, I've broken my leg, my life is now different, and they become depressed because they've lost freedom they understood. As opposed to saying, how is my body now telling me? Yes, my body's telling me that I'm getting older and I have to rethink of things, but the body's also saying is I need to have this new challenge in my life that will define me in these last years. Most people, we don't do a good job on diagnosing kind of that depression that comes out of that trauma, and helping people with that, because it is really a reassessment at that moment of saying, okay, I'm now a person that has had a serious break, and I have titanium in my body now. My body is different. The doc, you know, from a physical point of view, is they should be able to overcome that, but often they don't, because it's an inability to redefine who they are. Yeah.
So it's so interesting, because it's kind of on two levels, right? One is adaptation and coping with something, some serious trauma. but then the other one is really defining who someone is sort of objectively, right? Mm-hmm. So like what is it that defines a human? And these are simple questions, yeah. Right? We should probably have started drinking before this. But what is it that defines somebody who's, let's say, you mentioned cognitive decline. How about somebody in a coma? Like, what is it that defines them as human?
Right, and that's that challenge that we find where people will say, you know, the argument there, part of that argument, let's start from that point of view, is that somebody will say, okay, this is an argument for euthanasia, you know, that they're not, because they cannot live a fully functioning life. At some point, are we extending life beyond cognitive ability to what I would say is thrive, you know, and how do we do that? And how do we define thriving? And thriving may be different at every decade of our life. How does somebody thrive when they're in a coma? Well, that's a tough one to answer. And, you know, I think I'd almost to say I can't answer that in that way to say, you know, what is the right answer? And often, and I'll take an example. I had a patient when I was working in a hospital, and she kind of came into the ER. I was working in the ER as a chaplain, and it turned out that she was in. The nurses would say, "By the way, this you're going to see this person. They're end stage liver failure," and it was like, okay, and they said, she's a closeted alcoholic and she has drunk herself to a place where the liver is not going to recover. And the family and her over the course of those weeks really had to figure out, you know, kind of, she wanted at one point to kind of say enough is enough. I'm in so much pain. And the family was like, well, if we can keep you going long enough and keep her kind of alive, then if she can last the time frame that the transplants said that you have to be so many weeks beyond alcoholism before we'll allow you to do this. And there was this dance that they were playing. And for the for this woman, it was extremely painful and ultimately something that she lost, you know, in terms of, and she died. And you know, there was a struggle of acceptance of saying, okay, when should we let go? Well, I think what I've learned over my years is that everybody has a different understanding of that. It's too hard to kind of create an objective time of saying we're done.
So, I mean, you know, as a religious man, mm-hmm. doesn't it bring up like the value of life in and of itself, right? Beyond thriving,
right?
Like I, you know, in Canada, right? They've really increased the amount of euthanasia that's going on now, and they're allowing people who are unhappy or depressed or for whatever reason to do assisted suicide,
right?
I mean, how do you square that with like right. the value of life from the religious lens that you're looking at this through?
Right. So I guess I would look at it from two points of view. One is that are we extending life past what is beneficial to anybody else? So to the family or to that person. So if we turn off those machines, if those machines weren't available, would that person be alive? You know, that's on one side of this. And the answer is often no, the person wouldn't be alive without that machines. And so the question then becomes this kind of playing percentages with the doctors of saying, okay, what percentages of this person in this situation would actually make it to make it to health again? And so there's that decision on it, right? And so there's those that are just extending life because we're not prepared to let this person go, right? So there's that side, or that person isn't ready to go, like, I don't want to die. And equally, we have on the other side of people who say, no, I just want to die. I've had enough. And when do we say, sure, we're going to help you with that. And so it's just, and that's where my kind of my, on the one side, the first part is that pastoral side of saying, when is enough for the family to say it's time to let go? And then the other side of this is where my suicide prevention hat comes on and says, you know, suicide is tends to be this crisis that people go through for a period of time. After they pass through that, they can return to health. And so suicide is not this thing that is forever. There are these, it's a momentary time where the brain is broken, if you will. And think of it as an arm being broken and you're just feeling the pain and wanting to end. That's like the brain is broken and wants to do the same thing. And in the Bible, we would talk about Jonah, who just said, you know, at times has said, you know, I want to die, right? And God's like, no, this is going to pass, right? Because he's upset and he's having a crisis, but this is going to move through. So there's both sides of those can be true at the same time, that we have people who are in chronic illness and are deteriorating in their lives and say, okay, yes, we're extending life beyond what would be normally, and we can make that decision as a family and as a person to say, no, I've had enough. The other side of it is this person actually just in a crisis, and if with treatment and care and support can recover and be fully capable? And so it's hard. It takes on that suicide prevention side is understanding that suicidal crisis often passes, and that so those people are wishing themselves dead through because of the collision of several different factors at once, really, at the end of the day, can move through that and return to a sense of thriving.
Well, it can actually be a change in brain chemistry, right?
Absolutely.
Severe grief or trauma that does mm-hmm. dissipate over time.
Yeah, yeah. There's not a doctor, so I can't get into that, but at least the in depth, but my understanding is, and the common understanding is that the suicidal crisis has come around because of the kind of really an intersection of several things at once. It can be economic impact. It can be biological as well. It can be family as well. And kind of all of those things coming together can create this perfect storm of which pushes people towards suicide. Yeah.
So now we'll get to the hard questions, okay?
waiter.
So, like, taking away the like inevitability of death in like a physical thing where people aren't emotionally ready to accept it, and looking at someone who is, say, healthy and will survive physically, but they choose or want to die. What if, and I like to take these unique circumstances because I think they're good thought experiments, right? But what if the person is not grieving, is not in deep depression, but for whatever reason just says, I don't want to keep living? What is the church's answer on that?
Right. Yeah. Depends on the church. I have to start with there. It really does depend on the church. But I would say, you know, so I'll speak from my point of view, since I can't even say that I'm speaking from my church's point of view, because we don't, we probably have a thousand different views. So I would say is life is worth living, and we've been given a gift of life that we didn't, as I would say to my sophomores, we get a lot of these kind of big questions in that class. But I would say is that you didn't make yourself into being. So what is your responsibility as somebody who is, you have been gifted life, not by yourself, by your parents, by divine spirit, by God, you've been brought into this world, not by choice, but you've been given this opportunity to live. Is it also your choice to say since you didn't have a choice to come into this world, do you have a choice to say, oh, I want these days to be over and I can't see a reason to live? If we pull apart the suicidal crisis, because that's in a sense a most people in this, in that situation of suicide would be like, no, I want to end my life. You know, I don't, you can give me a thousand different reasons to, that I live, but my brain is hurting so much and I cannot reason with myself. I cannot create that, that rational thought. Is, I say that it, that suicide is either the most rational, irrational decision one makes, or it's the most irrational, rational decision one makes. I mean, it's both of those can be true. And it's this sense of we did not bring ourselves into this world. And so it's a gift to be in this world. So my, my point in all this would be it's fight like hell to stay in the world.
So what, and it's interesting, right? Because you have philosophical and, mm-hmm. and like this, that the libertarian position on that would be like, you own your body, right? Mm-hmm. You are in charge. It should be your decision. Where, what is the church's role, your church's role, mm-hmm. like in dealing with governments that now want to like even impose euthanasia or allow or legalize certain assisted suicide versus like, should the individual be given that choice? Or is that something that as a church that you would fight against with a government doing it? Like it's one thing if it's just you and right. the individual. It's a third thing if you have a government that's imposing itself over the top.
Interesting. So I mean, I had a situation where I was brought into a hospital room. The person was, you know, the sense was he was not going to live. You know, he was in the last hours of his life. And I got there and the room was full of family. And my concern in that moment was like, okay, who's making this decision here? Whose agency is going on? You know, whose power is being used in this moment? Is he being coerced at all to say you should, you know, that we end his life? Because I'm having a quite rational, reasoned conversation with somebody who was very lucid in that moment, mm-hmm. right? There was no reason to say, you know, I'm like, I'm talking to this person saying, you know, okay, in 2 hours, you're going to be dead. Are you okay? You know, are you okay with this? Is anyone forcing you to do this? I mean, is this coming from some place in the family or something along the way to say, okay, no, we're going to, you know, I've had enough. And, you know, do we need to relook at this? So outside influence, I mean, that's difficult in itself. But then to say that as the state says, you know, because we're a dispassionate entity that can lay down some rules to say within this structure, you may, or we're going to end, you know, we are going to determine that you end your life. I mean, that's a hard decision, you know, as that's a hard bridge to cross, I think, for most Americans, you know, just kind of the way we're set up in the country. But I also think it becomes from the church's point of view, is saying the state doesn't have a say here because it's because we're functioning out of what we would say is a higher source of authority, which is God. So, and then we would look to the scriptures about that.
So, I mean, the most basic function of government is to protect life or protect citizens from harming each other. But it gets a little murky when the person individual is harming themselves,
right?
But it's clearly based on morality, and it's a morality that the state in this case is saying that life has value. So, where does that morality come from in a secular government? Is it the will of the mob? Is it the masses that are all agreeing on something, or do you think it's so infused in like Western governments that it comes from? I mean, they were all founded on a Judeo-Christian ethic.
Right. I was going to bail out on the second one and just say
do whatever you want.
There's just say here about you know Judeo-Christian values and let's just leave it at that. You know, so can a sec? What would a secular, when we pull out any type of religious morality out of an institution, out of the institutions, to say, is it a utilitarian point of view that says this person is or isn't useful anymore to the wider society, therefore that person should die? I think that the church would say to the state, no, because the value of life has more to do than just the utilitarianness of a life. And but you know, what is the state saying? You know, we have a view that says we have a set of principles that by which the individual can express themselves. And if you can't do that, versus utilitarian, but a goal of human participation in this society, you know, if you can't meet those markers, then you need to have your life ended. Again, I think that's a hard one for as a religious person to put my head around to say, you know, is that what it is?
So when you're talking about a secular government, talking about the value of the individual to society, when they no longer have that, maybe they don't have, that's sort of a Marxist philosophy, right?
Yeah.
I've always been curious in people's opinions on this, but like, what do you think of like liberation theology? And when you have this sort of merging of Marxism, which is atheism, right, with you're talking about with Christianity, like how do those two things work together? But beyond the generalized, like, you know, taking care of the poor and you know, some of the other tenets of liberation theology.
I mean, if I remember back to my seminary days correctly, some of the seminary type people here will go to them for correction if we need to afterwards. But liberation theology kind of came out of Central America and the Catholic priests looking at institutions and saying, hey, wait a minute. These greater institutions like America and the international corporations are really not friendly to the people that I am serving on the ground. You know, it's an exploitative relationship that's going on, or, you know, going on here. And the worst part of that is the poor people. And so they're going to argue to the institution saying, hey, you've got to step back and understand that what you're doing is hurting individuals or hurting people, particularly poor people in our part of the world. And I think so is a fundamental philosophy of liberation theology. Coming from that, you say that, and you're going to help me because I've traced down this and I've lost your question.
I was just, because they seem like contradictory ideas, mm-hmm. right? It's Christianity with an atheistic Marxism, right? Which is more social economic. And then, so I understand it's representing the same people and how those two things could come together and find commonality, but one secular and one isn't. And they both value human life in opposing ways, I would say.
Right. So I guess from the pure, I can't really address the Marxist side, but the liberation theology side is that the impoverished person has value that the institutions are bludgeoning, if you will, or corrupting and diminishing. And so the liberation theology is to fight against that. And so from that point of view, how does that hold up to a Marxist point of view? If my general understanding of that is that the wider society, that the government is there to state for all of the population, this is the most non-exploitative relationship that we can create, that's our objective. Now, they would overlap. Our Venn diagram would be right. Like, yeah, you know, there. That's good for many people, right? Mm-hmm. But the question is the right location of that equity coming out of the government? You know, and how well does the government is, if it's Marxist or it's communist or socialist or capitalistic? You know, what gets us from to meeting that goal best, and is, you know, that's up to opinion.
In some ways, I'm sorry, so many questions because it's really interesting, right? In some ways, like in a Western democracy where you have sort of the will of the people, you know, the representative government, in some way this like secular religious divide kind of shadows on the cave wall because the morality is coming from the people who are voting, right? And so it's sort of, you know, it's a lot of different religion and whatever, but it's still infusing what their voting decisions are, even if the government itself isn't pushing a single religion.
Right. And I'm thinking back to Thomas Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptist Association back soon after he was elected president. And that group of clergy wrote to Jefferson saying, hey, we sense that you're fairly secular, you know, you're not religious like we are. Are we going to be okay? Or is the state going to say something to us that we don't like? And their worry is that, are you going to bring us back into something that looks like England, where the state has a lot of say over religion, and we don't want that as Americans now, that we want as what we call a separation of church and state. And that's his response was to write that there's a wall of separation between church and state, and was concerned at that point more of that the varied religions in the U.S. at that time were going to somehow suffer, or there was going to be some sort of established religion or completely no religion allowed. And in that, how did that would curtail the freedom that was essentially outlined in the Second Amendment. And so I got that in my amendment right? Okay. So that freedom of religion, First Amendment. Yeah, thank you. Stopping there because I knew I was wrong. So second clause of the First Amendment is that, yeah. So in that separation was not that the individual can't say, with religious views, can't say to the state, I want you to move in this or that direction, or if an elected person even holds certain religious views, it's that the state can't say, by the way, we want you to function in X, Y, or Z. I mean, the simplest way to look at it is from certainly from the Episcopal point of view, is when we see in the Church of England, which is our brothers and sisters in the Anglican Communion, and we see the Archbishop of Canterbury, you know, kind of putting, you know, vesting the king with divine symbols. And in that relationship is there is an established church in England, whether people attend it or not is, you know, that's the challenge. But in the U.S., you know, we don't want to have, you know, pick your minister du jour to say whether it's Billy Graham or whether it's a Catholic or a Jewish rabbi or someone coming in to say, oh, we are affirming the secular state in this way. And then there's a sense of that the state should function in a certain way. So we have this separation that kind of makes it almost impossible to answer the question in some ways. Because we are so invested as a country in this way.
We'll just add it to the list of impossible questions, right?
Right.
Because
right,
really, these are very difficult. People have been battling with this stuff forever. Do you think one last question about this, and we'll get back. Do you think that people today like misunderstand the separation of church and state, and that, you know, some of the founding fathers were deists, but everyone was religious, right? And they often spoke about a democracy not surviving if people didn't have religion, if people didn't have that morality that was inherent in them to drive the government. Do you feel like people misunderstand that now, looking at it as there can be no religion or religious morality in government or in the way we conduct public business?
I think the intent from the that letter from the Danbury Baptist Association to Jefferson and Jefferson's response was a much more concerned about the state dictating what happens in the pews, mm-hmm. And what can and can't be done, and versus what an individual and their own personal views and rights and understanding and knowledge and education brings to their position in government. And so it's we've seemingly seemed to flip it, mm-hmm. in some ways, that some folks say, hey, listen, you cannot react to any decision on in a way that's based on your religious beliefs or your core fundamental beliefs, that you need to be somehow devoid of that any sort of religious influence when you're voting on whatever the measure is. And it's that's not what we were concerned as a country way back. And the easiest example is this, or one another example is, look at England, is that I have a friend over there who's contemporary, and he and I are doing the same, kind of same work, and I'm paid by the congregation and he's paid by the state as if he's a postal worker. Mm-hmm. He's a civil servant and paid by the government of England to serve in his position. His frustration is, no matter how good or bad I'm doing at my job, I'm still getting paid the same pay as the schlep down the street who's not doing his job well at all. And that's frustrating. But it from the American point of view, is saying, I wouldn't want to be paid by the U.S. government, mm-hmm. Or the state of Virginia to do my job. That's not the right relationship.
I could go down a giant libertarian rabbit hole here, but okay. Let's get back to your book, okay? So when you talk about self and self-identity and people rediscovering themselves, mm-hmm. like we were talking earlier about like injury and brain injury, for example, does who you are and your value as a person like reside within your mind? Or is it, I'll ask you an easy question. What is the soul?
Right, because because I knew you were going there. Once you started down this path again, I said, okay, I think this one, we're going to land on the soul. So what is the soul? It's been something that's been debated and kind of examined for centuries within Christian thought, all the way back Augustine and probably earlier. Is kind of what is, and certainly I think the Greeks probably had a good try to understand that as well. So, what is the soul is that which, on the one hand, is that which that extends beyond life. It's that part of us that is, that extends beyond death, excuse me, beyond that, that carries us forward into eternal life. That would be certainly a Christian point of view. It is also this understanding of that which, kind of, okay, so let's put aside the afterlife, life after death questions, and let's look at it in terms of present experience. And I would say it's that which we can connect with the parts of the world that we would consider spiritual, right? So we wouldn't use our intellect and we wouldn't use our feelings per se. But the mystics will say that there is this thing called the soul by which we can communicate and have union and connection, not only with God, but with the world on a deep and spiritual level. So what does that mean? Is on the very kind of the most subtle and most kind of base level, is somebody goes out tonight and stands up, we can't watch the sunset from here well because our location had it facing west. But if we could get to the highest building in town, we would watch the sunset. And if we were watching the sunset, and you'd have this sense of, wow, I am deeply connected to the world. That is a common response to a glorious sunset, is that people say, I now have this deep sense of connection. That connection, that plug and socket, that tying together, the connection, the knot that holds that two together, would be the soul. Is that it's, yes, intellectually I can see, well, the sun is setting and these are the colors. I can feel that sunset and change of temperature, but I also can feel it as emotion, that it's, I'm drawing, being drawn out emotion. But the connectedness, that answers the why, is the answer and seed of the soul that says, why do I matter with this beautiful sunset? That's the answer to that. And whether it's that or somebody's looking up at the stars or the moon, that's that, the locus of that is the soul, that's that response that we're getting there.
So does that soul have value beyond, like we're talking about somebody who's like in a coma or brain dead or whatever, is that where the value resides in a human?
Well, I think that from a religious point of view, yes, right, that ultimately whether one is talking about liberation theology or one is talking about the most conservative or liberal types of theologies, that we are getting back to the central fact that the soul is this divine, the divine connection, maybe the divine gift, perhaps, that allows us to be who we are as each individual. And the gift is that we feel that we matter.
Is the soul distinct from consciousness?
No idea.
I don't think anybody does, but I mean, it's interesting, right? Even a lot of secular philosophers believe consciousness resides outside the body, right. So, I mean, are people using just different language, you think, to talk about the same thing?
I guess so. I mean, I'm not well enough versed in the philosophers to be able to answer that, fully. I'm sure somebody can come up with, here's my philosopher that will differ to the point of view. But what I would say is that our ability to connect with that which was beyond us, whether that's, or in the subconscious to some degree, yes and no. I mean, I think it's they have different functions, I think. So I would say that the subconscious is different than the soul.
So there's been a huge drop, obviously, in people going to church, mm-hmm. right? And a lot of young people identify as spiritual but not religious. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, what do you think of that? Like, is that just a lack of understanding of various religions, or is that, why are they saying that?
Well, there's a whole lot of reasons why people have gone that, kind of those that have studied that say there's not just one reason, so there's multiple reasons. So we'll put that up. We'll keep that with us and our basket of reasons. But then I will say that on the one hand, we the church deserve some of what this result is, right? We didn't care for people well enough through the years, that there are times that the church has been good and the time the church has been not so good. And so, and it's not just the Catholic Church that has abuse scandals, right? That that extends across numerous denominations. And so part of what we're experiencing in that distrust of the church is, well, we earned that by not being good protectors of the people that were in our care. So some of that is due to that. I think some of it is not the inability for the church to be able to answer some of the biggest questions, which are things like, why do good people suffer if God is good?
And that's, could you just tell everybody the answer to that one? That'd be great.
Come to my class in the fall and we'll debate that. But there isn't a good, And that is perhaps the hardest answer, is to get our heads around, is to say it either takes a presumption that God is good and all loving, and why would a loving and good God do that? Or does it take it from the side of perhaps God is, we're defining God inappropriately, and that maybe God isn't so narrowly focused the way we think God is, perhaps. And then perhaps the world that we live in is a little bit different in terms of priorities than just us and on that.
What is, in your opinion, the greatest argument for the existence of God?
Right. So I'm glad you asked this, because these are the questions that I had with my students. They're now in their 30s, but back in the day, they were 14, 15 year olds, and there's a couple of classic arguments. And one of those is that there can't be an infinite series of causes, right? So we can't just keep going back and back and back and saying, well, the reason I'm here is because of this and this and this and this, all the way back, and it just carries on to infinity. There has to be a first cause, right? So one of the existing arguments for God is that there's a first cause, and that first cause is God. So the question is, well, what was before the Big Bang, or what initiated the Big Bang? And one would say, well, maybe it came out by itself, or it's a series of big bangs that have just happened over and over and over again. But we still have to get to the point where there is a big bang, or there's a beginning. And then what's before the beginning?
That always drives me crazy from that. Right. It's a series of big bangs, and this one came from another, and so expansion and contraction and big bangs.
okay, but right. You know, but right. What happened before that?
Yeah.
And where was this universe? What's outside the universe?
Right. Yeah. Because if there's a universe, and if it's expanding, it's expanding into what? And so there's a question of kind of, well, where, so what is beyond universe? And there's all sorts of reasons to argue that. So that's one of the arguments for it is that there has to be a first cause.
There is an argument in physics for creating something out of nothing,
mm-hmm.
but it never made sense to me. I mean, there, it seems like there, just that argument alone is pretty persuasive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that would be, so the basic, where I would settle on this is that it is more reasonable to believe that there is a God than there isn't a God. And the reasons are, is that we have these arguments of which one is this first cause, and that then we can say, you know, actually, when we boil it all down to it, it lends itself that there was more reasons to think that there was that there is a divine creator behind all of this. The other one would be something where we would talk about intelligent design, two things. One is that we can put down most of the most important formulas of the critical formulas of the universe on one piece of paper, and they're mathematically we can do them, and that it's intelligible, that we can actually understand the universe as that there's an intelligence behind it. That would be another thing. And using kind of these two arguments together, you can say, well, it's more reasonable, though I can't prove it, but it's more reasonable that there is some sort of intelligent first cause than not.
I mean, to what extent do you think, like, post-scientific revolution, people's reliance on the provable or the replicable has damaged their ability to understand things that we can't, that are beyond our understanding?
Yeah, so Newton really in his, when he was in Copernicus, they were interested in trying to understand the universe and as a religious quest, as a spiritual quest for them, and not an abstract concept, that they were trying to understand God through science. And so, again, kind of as we talked about the sense of that Jefferson's letter in the wall of separation of church and state, is here's another one that feels like it's flipped, right? That science is somehow antithetical to religion. This is the point of what the modern science was really founded as, a theological study of the world.
So you find them compatible?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I would agree. And how do you look at, like you mentioned the rules of the universe, right? So, like, you know, quantum mechanics and general relativity are incompatible, right? They're different systems that don't make sense within the same thing. And things like, you know, Einstein's spooky action at a distance, quantum entanglement, right? That was something that can't happen, you know, and yet it does. Right. And so we clearly don't understand even the rules of the universe. You know, so do you feel like, you know, for tens of thousands of years, people believed in ghosts and they believed in the afterlife and they believed in this presence of God in everyday life. And then people gotten away from that, trying to rely on what they could, like, touch, you know, and feel and see. Right. Do you feel like there's a lack of ability now for people to try to look at things? You say the church doesn't have answers. Maybe, we can't have all the answers to this stuff. Do you think it's harder for people now to understand that, just not take faith in some of these things?
So I'm going to start, no moans of out of the group, please. So I'm going to start in the 14th century, the 14th century, right? There's some here that are rolling their eyes. In the 14th century, you know, 1348, ship lands in Italy, and the beginnings of the bubonic plague start, right? And it cuts the population of Europe in half up to that point. And it was such that in some cities there was no one left, and in other cities there were many more people left. And it struck in a way that really began to undermine the medieval sense of theology of how God worked in the world, that it was so utterly drastic to lose half of populations, that there's a story of a monastery that where the plague hit the monastery, and after it was finished, one monk and the dog left, and everybody else was dead. And so there's this abject, horrific, this illness that decimates the land, and the church didn't have a good enough response then. I think the church's theology wasn't sophisticated enough to meet the halving of a population of a continent, you know, that, or if it was a third, it wasn't enough to explain why God would do this, and why would these people be left and all of those people are not. And so that's one of those kind of, it's one of the things first causes that sets in motion the asking of the questions that bring around the Enlightenment, that because the aftershock of the plague, and it came back, but the aftershock of the plague was so devastating that it reshook every, you know, kind of everything, and kind of said, we need to, you know, evaluate, well, what is truth and what is real and what is God in this world? And so in the long arc of that, of going through the Enlightenment period is forward, is that we have this sense of science kind of providing the answers to what the church couldn't in the medieval period, because it was in a completely kind of religious society at that point, in a way that even ours today isn't. So, yeah.
But doesn't trauma tend to make people more religious, or make them look more at God or the eternity when they're closer to death? So why would just so much more death have the opposite effect?
Because I think it was so destructive and so complete, you know, that it felt like everything was just ending, and that life then, that the structure of life no longer mattered in the way that it had been set up. And so some did actually become much more religious. And we would say, again, in the 14th century is the golden age of mysticism, that there were more mystics during that time than almost any other period in history. And that we have these deeply religious people kind of cutting themselves off and away from society and focusing on really introspectively and just the relationship with God. Wonderful writings that come out of that, but the effect of it is this substantial change that gets heightened along the way, because the answers that people are searching for, the church isn't doing a good enough job answering them, and so people begin to look elsewhere. So I think it's a kind of a process by which things were reshuffled and changed.
In your book, you talk about using the Bible as a tool to rediscover self.
Right.
Is that a way to try to get? Do you think one of the outcomes of that would be having people look more at religion as a way to help them navigate life?
I do. I mean, and part of the reason I look at the Bible in this way is we can read the Bible in lots of different ways, and God's word brought to us through humans, that God said, you're going to write for me. And but within that, and what they wrote is all about relationships and messy human relationships. We can go from the point of view, we'll start in with some of the closest relationships that Jesus had, which was with Mary and Martha and Lazarus, these three people who lived in Bethany, which is just a few miles from Jerusalem. And Lazarus dies, and Mary and Martha, these are the two that one was listening to Jesus after dinner, and the other one was cleaning up after dinner, and there was a bit of a fight between the two sisters there. And so we have that really, you know, kind of family dynamic that's going on right there. And then we have Lazarus who dies, and Jesus shows up late, and you know, the sisters are very upset that, you know, you are our friend and you could have come and healed him, but you didn't. And Jesus says, well, wait a minute, I can fix this. But the putting aside the miracle first, And before we get to the miracle, it's a set of human relationships of people being decidedly just as people have been in forever. And if we go, then if we push all the way back to, we'll take into the book, early book of Genesis, where we have Cain and Abel, right? After Adam and Eve are out of the garden, we have Cain and Abel. And what happens there? You know, just after everybody's out of the garden, the first murder comes around, you know, out of jealousy. And it's not just any kind of murder, but it's brothers killing, you know, brother killing a brother. Well, that is about as family-oriented relationships as you can get, and it just carries through the entire Bible that it's relationships that David, who is the harp player for Saul, the king of Israel at the time, and Saul himself is somebody who has just abject points of depression, and he acts out with throwing things at David and wanting to kill him, you know, and all of those kind of things happen. And then Saul's son, Jonathan, who's David's friend, says, listen, I'll intercede. All of this is relational and how everything happens. And so we can read the Bible in lots of different ways, but what's really interesting is to read to say, hey, in this text are a lot of human relationships, and they're really interesting in themselves.
Is it when you can go back thousands of years and see the same like toil and the same frailty in humanity, is that something that's supposed to bring people assurance, or is it something that would make them cynical? Because we haven't seemed to figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, I think a little both. I mean, you know, certainly I grew up outside of the New York area, so cynicism's not a bad thing. That's actually pretty good. However, I think it's kind of, in a sense, it's reassuring that when you look at the Bible in this way to say, you know what, humans are humans, and yet the divine still cares for us, and it's still important, it still matters, and God is still wanting to have a relationship.
That's wonderful. I realize we've gone over time already. I haven't even asked you anything about the book. So real quick, because we're literary salon.
Like how
long did this take you to write?
This took probably a series of months. You know, it was just something that I would sit down every day and kind of work on a day every day. So it's a study that one can sit down and do this over the process of 36 days. So I say take Sundays off. So over the course of 6 weeks or so. So one can really sit down. And so I was writing that process of kind of, I'm going to do one a day. Then I had to rewrite and change. And
I mean, that's so incredibly fast. Yeah. Did your writing help you think through problems? And did you change your mind on anything in the course of writing about it?
I think it was an unfolding. For me, writing is a bit of an unfolding. I wish it was, at times I'm more structured, but often it's, I write, And I address things as I go along. So it's kind of problem solving as I go, and then having to go back and clean it up.
And what do you write in? Do you write in Word, or do you write with a pen and paper?
Yeah, principally Word. Yep. I've come to a place where I'm okay with that. So, but if I'm writing, so for instance, if I'm writing poetry, I've got a number of poems published recently, and those may either be handwritten and or typed. Yeah.
Do you listen to music when you write?
There were times I did, but no, not now. It's distracting.
Can you write anywhere, or do you have a specific place and time when you have to write?
I want to be able to write in a specific place and time that I've kind of dedicated for myself, but I never do.
Well, you still get it done really quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like, today I'm sitting here. Yeah.
Okay, I'm gonna come around. Does anybody have a question? If you do, just raise your hand and I'll have you speak into the mic so it comes out on the
make it easy
podcast.
Make them easy.
Like anybody, what is the meaning of life? Just something simple like that. Any questions about the writing or the book itself? Next. What's next is the question.
Oh, what's next? That's interesting. So, I've just gotten in print this week a book a biography of somebody who was in Alexandria, Virginia in the 1850s, a seminary student. That just came into print. So that would be the most of next thing that's just happened. We've just wrapped that up, and the contributors to that book were awesome. As I've said, I've gotten a couple of poems that 2024 was a poetry year of kind of writing and getting back to that for me. And then I've got a project with a friend that we should be writing putting it in gear has been slow. And I also, not that it, this is for me fun. It's more, you know, kind of in your area, but I, when I really want to just kind of mentally play is in the area of fiction writing. So.
Wow. You are everywhere. Yeah, I'd actually love, we're going to do a poetry event at some point in the near future. I've had several poets come in here.
Cool.
So I'll have to reach out to you when we do that. It'd be fun to have it here.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to, one of the most important things I think about this book, and it's a good book, right? But is that I have so many like atheist friends here, and we talk about things, but a lot of times their vision of like religious people is very simplistic, mm-hmm. you know? But like, as we can tell from this conversation, right? People who have studied this have thought more about these issues that are incredibly complex than anybody, you know? So I find it really interesting. I think books like this can be incredibly helpful for people.
I was at a talk not too long ago that somebody said, "Well, I'm an atheist. You know, should I read your book?" And I said, "Well, I said sure. You can do the first 5 weeks, no problem. And then I said the last week, you know, you're just going to have to you'll live into that and see where you land, because that was the kind of real God stuff, you know, in there. And so, but I also felt that." She said, "Well, I've never really read the Bible, and I feel comfortable with that." And I said, "You know what you can do is that you can read everything, right, and not open the Bible. You can go to the what I call additional resources, and you can open up, you know, listening to some music mm-hmm. about one's relationship with home,
mm-hmm.
And there's all sorts of songs on that. I think there's the one I might have used was something that goes like, 'I'm coming home.'" And what does that mean? And how do we write on that? So it can be used by atheistic people if, you know, they kind of want to, okay, I'm not going to look at the Bible, but I can move my way through it. So one could, yeah, certainly.
That's good. Well, congratulations Thank on you. Your book. It's really wonderful. Thanks. It's a big accomplishment. Thank please you. Please give him a nice warm welcome.
Congratulations.